Boys in knickers ran alongside the car with bulky loads of piecework on their shoulders. Evelyn saw stores with Hebrew signs in the windows, the Hebrew letters looking to her like arrangements of bones. She saw the iron fire escapes on the tenements as tiers of cell blocks. Nags in their yokes lifted their bowed necks to gaze at her. Ragmen struggling with their great junk-loaded two-wheel carts, women selling bread from baskets carried in their arms. They all looked. The driver was nervous. He wore gray livery with black leather jodhpurs. He nosed the shiny car through the narrow, filthy streets. A girl in a pinafore and high lace shoes sat playing in the muck along the curbstone, a little dirty-faced girl. "Stop the car," Evelyn said. The driver ran around and opened the door. Evelyn stepped into the street. She knelt down. The girl had straight black hair that fitted her head like a helmet. She had olive skin and eyes so brown they were black. She gazed at Evelyn without curiosity. She was the most beautiful child Evelyn had ever seen. A piece of clothesline was tied around her wrist. Evelyn stood up, followed the clothesline, and found herself looking to the face of a mad old man with a closely cropped gray beard. The end of the line was tied around the old man's waist. He wore a threadbare coat. One sleeve was torn. He wore a soft cap and a collar with a tie. He stood on the sidewalk in front of a display card of framed silhouette portraits pinned to a black velvet curtain. He was a silhouette artist. With nothing but a small scissors and some glue, he would make your image by cutting a piece of black paper and mounting it on a white background. The whole thing with a frame cost 15 cents. 15 cents, lady, the old man said. Why do you have this child tied with a rope? Evelyn said. The old man gazed at her finery. He laughed and shook his head and talked to himself in Yiddish. He turned his back to her. A crowd had gathered when the car stopped. A tall working man stepped forward and removed his hat with respect before translating for Evelyn what the old man had said. "Please, missus," he said. "So the little girl is not stolen from him." Evelyn had the feeling the translator was also something of a diplomat. The old artist was laughing bitterly and thrusting his chin in her direction, obviously commenting on her. "He says the rich lady may not be aware that young girls in the slums are stolen every day from their parents and sold into slavery." Evelyn was shocked. "This child can't be more than 10, she said. The old man began to shout and pointed across the street at a tenement house, and turned and pointed to the corner, and turned and pointed to the other corner. "Please, missus," the tall working man said. "Married women, children, anyone they can get their hands on. They defile them, and then in shame the female gives her life to vagrancy. Houses on this very street are used for this purpose." "Where are the child's parents?" Evelyn demanded. The old man was now talking to the crowd, beating his breast and pointing his finger in the air. A woman in a black shawl shook her head and moaned in sympathy. The old man took off his hat and tugged at his hair. Even the tall working man forgot to translate, so moved was he by the account. "Please, missus," he finally said. "This man himself is the child's father." He pointed to the artist's torn sleeve. "His own wife, to feed them, offered herself, and he has now driven her from his home and mourns her as we mourn the dead. His hair has turned white in the last month. He is 32 years old. The old man, weeping and biting his lip, turned to Evelyn and saw now that she too was moved. For a moment, everyone standing there on the corner shared his misfortune. Evelyn, the chauffeur, the working man, the woman in the black shawl, the onlookers. Then one person walked away, then another. The crowd dispersed. Evelyn made her way to the little girl still sitting at the curb. She knelt down, her eyes dewy, and looked into the face of the dry-eyed girl. "Hey, pumpkin," she said. Thus began Evelyn Nesbitt's concern for the 32-year-old geriatric artist and his daughter. The man had a long Jewish name that she couldn't pronounce, so she took to calling him Tata, the name by which the little girl called him. Tata was president of the Socialist Artists Alliance of the Lower East Side. He was a proud man. Evelyn discovered that there was no way to approach him except by coming to have her silhouette done. Over a period of 2 weeks, the old man executed 140 silhouette portraits of Evelyn. After each one, she would hand him 15 cents. Sometimes she demanded a portrait of the little girl. Tata executed over 90 of these, and he took more time with them. Then Evelyn asked for double portraits of herself and the little girl. At this the old man looked directly at her, and a terrible Hebraic judgment seemed to flash from his eyes. Nevertheless, he did as he was asked. As time went on, it became apparent to Evelyn that while people sometimes stopped to watch the old man work, very few people asked to have their portraits done. He began to create more and more intricate silhouettes, full-figured with backgrounds of Evelyn, of the little girl, of a drayman's horse plodding by, of five men in stiff collars sitting in an open car. With his scissors he suggested not merely outlines, but textures, moods, character, despair. Most of these are today in private collections. Evelyn came nearly every afternoon and stayed for as long as she could. She dressed down to be as inconspicuous as possible. Following a thought practice, she paid great sums of money to the chauffeur to keep him quiet. Gossip columnists began to infer from Evelyn's disappearances that she was engaging in reckless liaisons, and her name was linked with dozens of men around town. The less she was seen, the more slanderous the reports became. She didn't care. She sneaked off to her new love interest on the Lower East Side. She wore a shawl over her head and a tattered black moth-eaten sweater over her shirtwaist. The chauffeur kept these for her under the car rug. She went to Tata's corner, stood for her portrait, and feasted her eyes on the little girl at the end of the clothesline. She was infatuated. And all this time there was no man in her life other than her mad husband, Harry K. Thaw. Unless she wanted to consider her secret admirer, the young man with the high cheekbones and blonde mustaches who followed her everywhere she went. She had seen him first at Tata's corner, standing across the street and turning his eyes away when she challenged him with her gaze. She knew her mother-in-law employed private detectives, but she decided he was too shy to be a detective. He had learned where she lived and what her daily routine was, but he never approached her. She felt not intimidated by his attention, but protected. Intuitively, she felt his admiration like a keenness in her own breath. At night, she dreamed of the little girl, woke up, thought of her. Plans for the future flashed in her mind like fireworks and quickly disappeared. She was anxious, overwrought, aroused, and unaccountably happy. She would testify on her husband's behalf and do it well. She was hopeful that he would be found guilty and locked up for life. The little girl in the pinafore held her hand but would not say anything to her. Even to Tata she spoke few words. Tata said, "No one mourns like a child, not even a lover." Evelyn realized that the old man's pride would have driven her off long ago if he had not perceived that her attentions to the little girl were helpful. One day Evelyn came from a portrait, and neither father nor daughter was to be seen. Fortunately, she had learned where they lived, on Hester Street, over a public bath. She went there now, walking quickly, not daring to think what was the matter. Hester Street was a teeming marketplace of peddlers who sold vegetables and fruits and chickens and breads from pushcarts lined up along the curb. The sidewalks were glutted with shoppers. Overflowing garbage cans stood in ranks beside the entrance stairs of every house. Bedding hung from fire escapes. Evelyn rushed up a flight of iron stairs and into a dark, incredibly foul-smelling hallway. Tata and the little girl lived on the top floor in two small rooms in the back. She knocked on the door. She knocked again. A moment later, it opened a crack. There was a chain latch in place. "What is the matter?" Evelyn said. "Let me in." Tata was scandalized by her visit. He stood in only his shirt and pants held up by suspenders, and he wore house slippers. He insisted that the front door be left open despite the rank winds that blew up the stairwell, and quickly put on his jacket and shoes. He hurriedly made up his cot, throwing over it a brightly colored spread. The little girl lay on a brass bed in the other room. She was ill with a fever. The two rooms were lit by candle. The bedroom, although it had a window, was almost as dark as the front room. It looked out on an air shaft. The whole place was no bigger than a closet. Yet as Evelyn's eyes accustomed themselves to the darkness, she perceived that the home was scrupulously clean. Her arrival had caused a storm of consternation in the old artist, who paced up and down in the candlelight and did not know what to do about her. In great agitation, he smoked a cigarette, which he held between his thumb and forefinger, palm up, in the European style. "I will stay with the child," Evelyn insisted, "while you go to work." Finally, the old man gave in, if only to avoid the terrible strain on himself of her presence in his home. He rushed out, carrying his display stand with its black velvet curtains folded over his arms and his wooden box like a suitcase that held his materials. Evelyn closed the door after him. She looked at the glass cabinet, at the few cups and plates of chipped crockery. She examined the bedding and the drawers, the scrubbed oak table and chairs where the family ate. There was a pile of unfinished knee pants on a sewing machine by the bedroom window. The window in the bedroom sparkled with the reflection of the candle. The brass of the thin little bed was shining. Evelyn felt a strong kinship with the departed mother. The girl looked at her from the pillows and neither smiled nor said anything. Evelyn removed the shawl, the old sweater, and put them down on a chair. In a packing crate laid on its end beside the bed, like an end table, books in Yiddish were stacked tightly. There were books in English, too, on socialism, and pamphlets on the covers of which working men with powerful linked arms were marching forward. None of them looked like the frail white-haired Tata. There were no mirrors on the walls and no photographs anywhere of the family, of the missing wife and mother. She found a tub of galvanized tin in the front room. She found a pail and went down the stairs and drew from the sink on the ground floor a pail of water. She warmed the water on the coal stove in the front room and went into the bedroom with the tub, the pail of water, and a thin starched towel. The little girl clutched the covers about her. Evelyn gently removed the covers and sat her up on the edge of the bed, raised her nightgown and stood her up and lifted the nightgown over her head, feeling like the sun the warm exhalations of her young body. "Come stand a moment in the tub," she said, and knelt in front of the girl and bathed her with the warm water, scooping it in her hands and caressing the child with her hands of water and doing it again on her tawny shoulders, her nut-brown budded nipples, her face, her downy back, her thin thighs, the smooth slope of her stomach, her girlhood, the sluiced water from her young fevered body falling like rain in the tub as Evelyn bathed her with her hands. Then, with the towel folded in quarters, she gently patted the little girl dry and dressed her fresh in another gown she'd found in the drawer, a larger gown this time of thin cotton, much too big, funny, so that the girl laughed. Evelyn smoothed the sheets and plumped up the pillows and settled the girl in bed again and felt her forehead, and it was cool. The little girl's dark eyes shone in the dusk. Evelyn combed her black hair and touched her face and leaned over her, and the little girl's arms went around Evelyn's neck, and she kissed her on the lips. This was the day Evelyn Nesbit considered kidnapping the little girl and leaving Tata to his fate. The old artist had never inquired of her name and knew nothing about her. It could be done. Instead, she threw herself into the family's life with redoubled effort, coming with food, linens, and whatever else she could move past the old man's tormented pride. She was insane with the desire to become one of them, and drew Tata out in conversation and learned from the girl how to sew knee pants. For hours each day, each evening, she lived as a woman in the Jewish slums and was driven home by the thaw chauffeur from a prearranged place many blocks away, always in despair. She was so desperately in love that she could no longer see properly. Something had happened to her eyes, and she blinked constantly as if to clear them of the blur. She saw everything through a film of salt tears, and her voice became husky because her throat was bathed in the irrepressible and continuous crying which her happiness caused her. Chapter 8. One day, Tata invited her to a meeting of which the Socialist Artists Alliance of the Lower East Side was a part sponsor, along with seven other organizations. It was an important event. The featured speaker was to be none other than Emma Goldman. Carefully, Tata explained that although he was unalterably opposed to Goldman, she being an anarchist and he a socialist, he had great respect for her personal courage and integrity, and that he had therefore agreed that some sort of temporary accord between the socialists and the anarchists was advisable, if only for the evening, because the funds raised for the occasion would go to support the shirtwaist makers who were then on strike, and the steel workers at McKeesport, Pennsylvania, who were on strike, and the anarchist Francisco Ferrer, who was going to be condemned and executed by the Spanish government for fomenting a general strike in Spain. In 5 minutes, Evelyn was immersed in the bracing linguistics of radical idealism. She didn't dare to confess to Tata that she had no idea socialism and anarchism were not the same thing, or that the thought of seeing the notorious Emma Goldman frightened her. She pulled her shawl over her head, and holding the little girl's hand tightly, walked behind Tata as he strode north to the workingman's hall on East 14th Street. But she did at one point turn around to see if her strange, shy admirer was following, and he was, half a block behind, his lean face hidden in the shadow of his straw booter. Emma Goldman's subject was the great dramatist Ibsen, in whose work, she said, lay all the instruments for the radical dissection of society. She was not a physically impressive woman, being small, thick-waisted, with a heavy-jawed masculine face. She wore horn-rimmed glasses that enlarged her eyes and suggested the constant outrage to her soul of the sight she saw. She had immense vitality, and her voice rang, and Evelyn, after getting over her relief to discover that Goldman was simply a woman, and a rather small woman at that, was swept up by the oratory of powerful ideas that lifted her mind like a river. In the heat and constant excitement rising from the audience, she allowed her shawl to drop to her shoulders. There were perhaps 100 people present, all sitting on benches or standing along the walls, while Goldman spoke from behind a table at the end of the room. The police department had stationed men prominently at the doors, and at one point a police sergeant tried to stop Emma's address, claiming she had been advertised to speak on the subject of the drama, but instead was talking about Ibsen. Jeers and catcalls drove him from the hall. Goldman, however, did not join the laughter, knowing from experience what an embarrassed police force inevitably did. She spoke now with great rapidity, and as she spoke her eyes ranged restlessly over the audience and came to stop again and again on the alabaster face of Evelyn Nesbit, who sat between Tata and the little girl in the first row on the right, a position of honor as befitted Tata's office as president of the Socialist Artists' Alliance. "Love in freedom," Goldman cried. "Those who, like Mrs. Alving, have paid with blood and tears for the spiritual awakening, repudiate marriage as an imposition, a shallow, empty mockery." Some of the audience, including Tata, shouted, "No, no." "Comrades and brothers," Goldman said, "can you socialists ignore the double bondage of one half of the human race? Do you think the society that plunders your labor has no interest in the way you were asked to live with women, not through freedom, but through bondage? All the reformers talk today of the white slavery problem, but if white slavery is a problem, why is marriage not a problem? Is there no connection between the institution of marriage and the institution of the brothel?" At mention of this word, cries of shame, shame filled the hall. Tata had put his hands over his daughter's ear and pressed her head to his side. A man stood and shouted. Goldman held up her hands for quiet. "Comrades, let us disagree, of course, but not by losing our decorum to the extent that the police may have an excuse to interrupt us." People turning in their seats indeed now saw a dozen policemen in the crowd at the doors. "The truth is," Goldman went on quickly, "women may not vote, they may not love whom they want, they may not develop their minds and their spirits, they may not commit their lives to the spiritual adventure of life, comrades, they may not. And why? Is our genius only in our wombs? Can we not write books and create learned scholarship and perform music and provide philosophical models for the betterment of mankind? Must our fate always be physical? There sits among us this evening one of the most brilliant women in America, a woman forced by this capitalist society to find her genius in the exercise of her sexual attraction, and she has done that, comrades, to an extent that a Pierpont Morgan and a John D. Rockefeller could envy. Yet her name is scandal, and their names are intoned with reverence and respect by the toadying legislators of this society." Evelyn went cold. She wanted to pull the shawl over her head, but was afraid that she would draw attention to herself. She sat perfectly still, staring at her hands in her lap. At least the woman had the grace not to look in her direction as she spoke. People in the audience who were craning their necks trying to locate the object of Goldman's remarks were diverted now by a shout from the back of the hall. A phalanx of blue coats jammed through the doors. There was a scream, and suddenly the hall was pandemonium. It was a typical conclusion to an Emma Goldman speech. Police poured down the center aisle. The anarchist stood calmly behind her table and put her papers in her briefcase. Evelyn Nesbit felt Tata's eyes upon her and turned into the glare of his judgment. He was looking at her as she had seen him look upon a roach before he stepped on it. Then his old face seemed to collapse into another, more complex set of wrinkles and lines. His entire being settled into the last age before death, and his eyes from the depths of his ancient skull translated for her the whispered Yiddish that came from his broken lips. "My life is desecrated by whores," is what he said. And grasping the hand of the little girl in the pinafore, he disappeared into the crowd. Evelyn stood staring after them. It seemed to her that the light was racing away from her eyes. Her hand went out for something to hold. A now familiar voice said in her ear, "This way, come with me," and her arm was in the grip of Goldman herself. It was a grip of iron. Goldman led her through a small door behind the speaker's table, and just before the door closed, Evelyn, letting a high, thin wail from her throat, looked back and saw her shy, blonde young shadow fighting his way furiously in her direction. "I'm an old hand at this," Emma Goldman said, leading her down a dark stairs. "This is just an ordinary evening." The stairs gave on to the street around the corner from the entrance to the meeting hall. A police van passed them, its bell clanging. It turned the corner. "Come," Emma Goldman said, linking her arm, and she walked Evelyn quickly away in the opposite direction. When Mother's younger brother reached the street, he just managed to see the two female figures passing under a street lamp two blocks away. He hurried after them. The evening was cool. The perspiration on his neck chilled him. A breeze whipped his duck trousers. He came to within a half block of the two women, and for some minutes followed them at this distance. They turned suddenly and went up the stone stairs of a brownstone. He ran now, and when he reached the brownstone, saw that it was a rooming house. He went inside and quietly went up the stairs, not knowing what room he was looking for, but sure somehow he'd find it. On the second landing, he backed into the shadowed recess of a door. Goldman, carrying a basin, passed on her way to the bathroom. He heard the sound of water running and found the open door to Goldman's room. It was a small room, and peeking around the door, he saw Evelyn Nesbit sitting on the bed, her face in her hands. Sobs shook her body. The walls were a faded lilac print. An electric lamp at the bedside provided the only light. Hearing Goldman coming back, younger brother soundlessly darted into the room and slipped into the closet. He left the closet door slightly ajar. Goldman placed the basin of water on the bed table and shook out a thin, starched face towel. "Poor girl," she said, "poor girl. Why don't you let me refresh you a bit? I'm a nurse, you know. That's how I support myself. I've followed your case in the newspapers. From the beginning, I found myself admiring you. I couldn't understand why." She unlaced Evelyn's high-top shoes and slipped them off. "Don't you want to put your feet up?" she said. "That's the way." Evelyn lay back on the pillows, rubbing her eyes with the heels of her hand. She took the towel offered by Goldman. "Oh, I hate to cry," she said. "Crying makes me ugly." She wept into the towel. "After all," Goldman went on, "you're nothing more than a clever prostitute. You accepted the conditions in which you found yourself, and you triumphed. But what kind of victory has it been? The victory of the prostitute. And what have your consolations been? The consolations of cynicism, of scorn, of contempt for the human male. Why, I thought, should I feel such strong sisterhood with this woman? After all, I've never accepted servitude. I've been free. I've fought all my life to be free, and I've never taken a man to bed without loving him, without taking him in love as a free human being, his equal, giving and taking in equal portions in love and freedom. I've probably slept with more men than you have. I've loved more men than you have. I bet it would shock you to know how free I've been and what freedom I've lived my life. Because, like all whores, you value propriety. You are a creature of capitalism, the ethics of which are so totally corrupt and hypocritical that your beauty is no more than the beauty of gold, which is to say, false and cold and useless." No other words could have so quickly stemmed Evelyn's tears. She lowered the towel from her face and stared at the stout little anarchist, who now paced back and forth in front of the bed as she spoke. "So why should I have felt such strong bonds between us? You are the embodiment and woman of everything I pity and abhor. When I saw you at my meeting, I was ready to accept the mystical rule of all experience. You came, because in such ways as the universe works, your life was destined to interact with my own. Through the vile depths of your own existence, your heart has directed you to the anarchist movement." Nesbitt shook her head. "You don't understand," she said. Tears filled her eyes once again. She told Goldman about the little girl in the pinafore. She told her of Tata and her secret life in the slums. "And now I have lost them," she said. "I have lost my urchin." She wept bitterly. Goldman sat down in the rocking chair beside the bed and placed her hands on her knees. She leaned toward Evelyn Nesbitt. "All right. If I had not pointed you out, your Tata wouldn't have run off. But what of it? Don't worry. Truth is better than lies. When you find them again, you'll be able to deal with them honestly as the person you really are. And if you don't find them, perhaps that will be for the best. Who can say who are the instrumentalities and who are the people? Which of us causes and lives in others to cause, and which of us is meant thereby to live? That is exactly my point. Do you know at one time in my life I walked the streets to sell my body? You're the first person I've ever told. Fortunately, I was spotted for the novice that I was and sent home. It was on 14th Street. I tried to look like a streetwalker, and I fooled no one. I don't suppose the name Alexander Berkman means anything to you." Evelyn shook her head. "When Berkman and I were in our early 20s, we were lovers and revolutionaries together. There was a strike in Pittsburgh, at the Homestead Steel Plant of Mr. Carnegie, and Mr. Carnegie decided to break the union. So he ran off for a European vacation and had his chief toady, that infamous piece of scum, Henry Clay Frick, do the job. Frick imported an army of Pinkertons. The workers were on strike to protest the cutting of wages. The plant is on the Monongahela River, and Frick towed his Pinkertons up the river and landed them at the plant from the river. It was a pitched battle. It was a war. When it was over, 10 were dead, and dozens were wounded. The Pinkertons were driven off. So then Frick was able to get the government working for him, and the state militia came in to surround the workers. At this point, Berkman and I decided on our attentat. We would give the beleaguered workers heart. We would revolutionize their struggle. We would kill Frick. But we were in New York, and we had no money. We needed money for a railroad ticket and for a gun. And that's when I put on embroidered underwear and walked 14th Street. An old man gave me $10 and told me to go home. I borrowed the rest. But I would have done it if I had to. It was for the attentat. It was for Berkman and the revolution. I embraced him at the station. He planned to shoot Frick and take his own life at his trial. I ran after the departing train. We only had money for one ticket. He said only one person was needed for the job. He barged into Frick's office in Pittsburgh and shot the bastard 3 times. In the neck, in the shoulder. There was blood. Frick collapsed. Men ran in. They took the gun. He had a knife. He stabbed Frick in the leg. They took the knife. He put something in his mouth. They pinned him to the ground. They pried open his jaws. It was a capsule of fulminate of mercury. All he had to do was chew on the capsule, and the room would have blown up and everyone in it. They held his head back. They removed the capsule. They beat him unconscious. Evelyn had sat up in bed, drawing her knees up to her chest. Goldman stared at the floor. "He was in prison 18 years, she said, "many of them in solitary in a dungeon. I visited him once. I could never bear to visit him again. And the bastard Frick survived and became a hero in the press, and the public turned against the workers, and the strike was broken. It was said we set back the American labor movement 40 years. There was another anarchist, Most, an older man whom I revered. He denounced Berkman and me in his newspaper. The next time I saw Most at a meeting, I was prepared. I had bought a horsewhip. I horsewhipped him in front of everyone. Then I broke the whip and threw it in his face. Berkman got out only last year. His hair is gone. He's the color of parchment. My darling young man walks with a stoop. His eyes are like coal pits. We are friends in principle only. Our hearts no longer beat together. What he endured in that prison I can only imagine, living in darkness, in wet, tied up and left to lie in his own filth. Evelyn's arm had gone out to the older woman, and Goldman now took her hand and held it tightly. We know, don't we, both of us, what it means to have a man in jail. The two women looked at each other. There was silence for some moments. "Of course, your man is a pervert, a parasite, a leech, a foul, loathsome sybarite," Goldman said. Evelyn laughed. "An insane pig," Goldman said, "with a twisted, shrunken little pig's mentality." Now they were both laughing. "Yes, I hate him," Evelyn cried. Goldman grew reflective. "But there are correspondences, you see. Our lives correspond. Our spirits touch each other like notes in harmony. And in the total human fate, we are sisters. Do you understand that, Evelyn Nesbit?" She stood and touched Nesbit's face. "Do you see that, my beautiful girl?" As she'd been talking, Goldman's eyes reacted to something in Evelyn's posture. "Are you wearing a corset?" she now asked. Evelyn nodded. "You ought to be ashamed of yourself. Look at me, even with my figure, I have not one foundation garment. I wear everything loose and free-flowing. I give my body the freedom to breathe and to be. That's what I mean. You're a creature of their making. You have no more need of stays than a wood nymph." She took Nesbit's hands and sat her up on the edge of the bed. She felt her waist. "My God, stays like steel. Your waist is pinched tighter than a purse string. Stand up." Evelyn stood up obediently, and Goldman, with a nurse's expertise, swiftly unbuttoned her shirt waist and removed it. She unclasped Evelyn's skirt and had her step out of it. She untied the strings of her petticoat and removed it. Evelyn wore a light corset around her waist. The top of the corset pushed up her bosom. The bottom was attached to straps which went between her thighs. The corset was laced in the back. "It is ironic that you were thought of in homes all over America as a licentious, shameless wanton," Goldman said, pulling the laces out of the grommets, loosening the garment, and pulling it down Evelyn's legs. "Step out," she said. Evelyn obeyed. Her undershift remained stuck to her body in the pattern of the stays. "Breathe," Goldman commanded. "Raise your arms, stretch your legs, and breathe." Evelyn obeyed. Goldman plucked at the shift and lifted it over her head. Then she knelt and slid Evelyn's lace-trimmed underdrawers to her feet. "Step out," she commanded. Evelyn did so. She now stood nude in the lamplight except for her black embroidered cotton stockings, which were held up by elastic bands around the thighs. Goldman rolled the stockings down, and Evelyn stepped out of her stockings. She held her arms across her breasts. Goldman stood and turned her around slowly for inspection, a frown on her face. "Look at that. It's amazing you have any circulation at all." Marks of the stays ran vertically like welts around Nesbit's waist. The evidence of garters could be seen in the red lines running around the tops of her thighs. "Women killed themselves," Goldman said. She turned back the bed covers. She took from the top of the bureau a small black bag of the kind that doctors carried. "A superb body like this, and look what you do to it. Lie down." Evelyn sat down on the bed and looked at what was coming out of the black bag. "On your stomach," Goldman said. She was holding a bottle and tilting the contents of the bottle into her cupped hand. Evelyn lay down on her stomach, and Goldman applied the liquid where the marks of the stays reddened the flesh. "Ow!" Evelyn cried. "It stings!" "This isn't astringent. The first thing is to restore circulation," Goldman explained as she rubbed Evelyn's back and buttocks and thighs. Evelyn was squirming and her flesh cringing with each application. She buried her face in the pillow to smother her cries. I know, Goldman said, but you will thank me. Under Goldman's vigorous rubbing, Evelyn's flesh seemed to spring into its fullest conformations. She was shivering now, and her buttocks were clenched against the invigorating chill of the astringent. Her legs squeezed together. Goldman now took from her bag a bottle of massage oil and began to knead Evelyn's neck and shoulders and back, her thighs and calves and the soles of her feet. Gradually Evelyn relaxed, and her flesh shook and quivered under the emphatic skill of Goldman's hands. Goldman rubbed the oil into her skin until her body found its own natural rosy white being and began to stir with self-perception. "Turn over," Goldman commanded. Evelyn's hair was now undone and lay on the pillow about her face. Her eyes were closed and her lips stretched in an involuntary smile as Goldman massaged her breasts, her stomach, her legs. "Yes, even this," Emma Goldman said briskly, passing her hand over the Mons. "You must have the courage to live." The bedside lamp seemed to dim for a moment. Evelyn put her own hands on her breast and her palms rotated the nipples. Her hands swam down along her flanks. She rubbed her hips. her feet pointed like a dancer's and her toes curled. Her pelvis rose from the bed as if seeking something in the air. Goldman was now at the bureau, capping her bottled emollient, her back to Evelyn, as the younger woman began to ripple on the bed like a wave on the sea. At this moment, a hoarse, unearthly cry issued from the walls. The closet door flew open, and Mother's younger brother fell into the room, his face twisted in a paroxysm of saintly mortification. He was clutching in his hands, as if trying to choke it, a rampant penis, which, scornful of his intentions, whipped him about the floor, launching to his cries of ecstasy or despair great filamented spurts of jism that traced the air like bullets and then settled slowly over Evelyn in her bed like falling ticker tape. Chapter 9. In New Rochelle, Mother had for days brooded about her brother. He had called on the telephone from New York once or twice, but would not say why he'd gone away or where he was staying or when he'd return. He mumbled. He was close-mouthed. She was furious with him. He did not respond to anger. Since his call, she had taken the extreme step of going into his room and looking around. As always, it was neat. There was his table with the machine for stringing tennis rackets. There was his skull oars in brackets on the wall. He kept his own room, and there was not a speck of dust even now in his absence. His hair brushes on the bureau top, his ivory shoehorn, a small shell shaped like a thimble with some grains of sand stuck to it. She'd never seen that before. A picture from a magazine pinned to the wall, the drawing by Charles Dana Gibson of that Evelyn Nesbit creature. He had packed nothing. His shirts and collars filled the drawer. She closed the door guiltily. He was a strange young man. He never made friends. He was solitary and impassive, except for a streak of indolence, which he either could not hide or did not care to. She knew Father found that indolence disturbing. Nevertheless, he had promoted him to greater responsibility. She could not share her worries with Grandfather, who had sired the young man at a late age and was now totally separated from any practical perception of life. Grandfather was in his 90s. He was a retired professor of Greek and Latin who had taught generations of Episcopal seminarians at Shady Grove College in central Ohio. He was a country classicist. He had known John Brown when he was a boy in Hudson County in the Western Reserve and would tell you that 20 times a day if you let him. More and more, since Father's departure, Mother thought of the old Ohio homestead. The summers there were gravid with promise, and red-winged blackbirds flew up from the hay meadows. The furnishings of the house were spare and country-made, ladder-back chairs of pine, polished wood floors of wide boards fastened with dowels. She loved that house. She and younger brother played on the floor by the light of the fire. In their game she always instructed him. In winter their horse Bessie was hitched to the sleigh, and bells were tied to her collar, and they skimmed over the thick, wet Ohio snowfalls. She remembered brother when he was younger than her own son. She took care of him. On rainy days, they played secret pretending games in the hayloft in the sweet warmth, with the horses snorting and nickering below them. On Sunday morning, she wore a pink dress and the purest white pantaloons and went to church with a heart beating with excitement. She was a large-boned child with high cheekbones and gray eyes that slanted. She had lived in Shady Grove all her life, except for 4 years at boarding school in Cleveland. She had always presumed she would marry one of the seminarians, but in her last year at school she had met Father. He was traveling through the Midwest to make local sales connections for his flag and bunting business. He called on her at Shady Grove on 2 successive business trips. When they married and she came east, she brought her father with her, and then because brother had not been able to settle himself, he too had joined the household in New Rochelle. And now, in this season of life, alone in her modern awninged home, at the top of the hill, on fashionable Broadview Avenue, with only her small son and her ancient father, she felt deserted by the race of males, and furious with herself for the nostalgia that swept through her without warning at any hour of the day or night. A letter had arrived from the Republican Inaugural Committee inquiring if the firm would care to bid on the decoration and fireworks contract for the inauguration parade and ball the following January, when Mr. Taft was expected to succeed Mr. Roosevelt. It was an historic moment for the business, and neither father nor younger brother was on hand. She fled to the garden for solace. This was the late September of the year, and all the heavy swaying flowers were in bloom, salvia, chrysanthemum, and marigold. She walked along the borders of the yard, her hands clasped. From an upstairs window the little boy watched her. He noted that the forward motion of her body was transmitted to her clothes laterally. The hem of her skirt swayed from side to side, brushing the leaves of grass. He held in his hand a letter from his father that had been posted from Cape York in northwest Greenland. It had been brought back to the United States by the supply ship Eric, which had transported to Greenland 35 tons of whale meat for Commander Perry's dogs. Mother had copied the letter and thrown the original in the garbage because it strongly suggested the smell of dead whale. The boy had retrieved the letter, and as time passed, the grease spots on the envelope were worked into every fiber of the paper by his small hands. The letter was now translucent. As the boy watched his mother, she came out of the dapple shade of the maple trees, and her golden hair, which she wore piled on her head in the style of the day, flared like the sun. She stood for a moment as if listening to something. She brought her hands up to her ears and slowly, by the flower bed, dropped to her knees. Then she began to paw the ground. The little boy left the window and raced downstairs. He went through the kitchen and out the back door. He found himself following the Irish housemaid, who was running through the yard, wiping her hands on her apron. Mother had dug something up. She was brushing the dirt from a bundle which she held on her lap. The maid let out a scream and crossed herself. The little boy tried to get a look at it, whatever it was, but Mother and the maid were on the ground, brushing the dirt off, and for a moment he couldn't get past them. Mother's face had turned so pale and suffered such an intense expression that all the bones of her face appeared to have grown, and the opulently beautiful woman he revered was shockingly haggard, like someone ancient. He saw, as they brushed the dirt away, that it was an infant. Dirt was in its eyes, in its mouth. It was small and wrinkled, and its eyes were closed. It was a brown baby, and had been bound tight in a cotton blanket. Mother freed its arms. It made a small weak cry, and the two women grew hysterical. The maid ran into the house. The boy followed his mother to the house, running alongside her as the small arms of the brown baby waved in the air. The women washed the baby in a basin on the kitchen table. It was bloody, an unwashed newborn boy. The maid examined the cord and said it had been bitten. They swaddled it in towels, and Mother ran to the front hall to phone the doctor. The boy watched the infant closely to see if it was breathing. It barely moved. Then its tiny fingers grasped the towels. Its head slowly turned, as if through its closed eyes it had found something to look at. When the doctor came, in his Ford doctor's car, he was shown into the kitchen. He held his stethoscope to the small bony rib cage. He opened the mouth and poked his finger down the throat. "These people," he said. He shook his head. The muscles of his cheeks pulled in his mouth at the corners. Mother described for him the circumstances of the discovery, how she had heard a cry coming from her feet, from the earth, and thought at the moment she had heard it that she had not heard it at all. "And what if I had walked on?" she said to herself. The doctor asked for some hot water. He removed an instrument from his bag. The maid tightly clutched the small cross that hung from her neck on a chain. The doorbell rang, and the boy followed her into the front hall. The police had arrived. Mother came out and explained the circumstances once again. The policeman asked if he could use the telephone. The telephone was on a table near the front door. He removed his helmet, picked up the phone, and put the receiver to his ear and waited for the operator. He winked at the boy. Within an hour, a black woman was found in the cellar of a home on the next block. She was a washwoman who worked in the neighborhood. She sat outside the house in the police ambulance, and Mother brought the baby out to her. When the woman took the baby in her arms, she began to cry. Mother was shocked by her youth. She had a child's face, a guileless brown, beautiful face. She was the color of dark chocolate, and her hair looked chopped and uncared for. She was being attended by a nurse. Mother stepped back on the sidewalk. "Where will you take her?" she said to the doctor. "To the charity ward," he said, "and eventually she will have to stand charges." "What charges?" Mother said. "Well, attempted murder, I should think." "Does she have a family?" Mother said. "No, ma'am," the policeman said, "not so's we know." The doctor pulled down on the rim of his derby and walked to his car and put his bag on the seat. Mother took a deep breath. "I will take the responsibility," she said. "Please bring her inside." And despite the best advice of the doctor and the remonstrations of the police, she would not change her mind. So the young black woman and her child were installed in a room on the top floor. Mother made numbers of phone calls. She canceled her service league meeting. She walked back and forth in her parlor. She was very agitated. She felt keenly her husband's absence and condemned herself for so readily endorsing his travels. There was no way to communicate with him any of the problems and concerns of her life. She would not hear from him till the following summer. She stared at the ceiling as if to see through it. The Negro girl and her baby had carried into the house a sense of misfortune, of chaos, and now this feeling resided here like some sort of contamination. She was frightened. She went to the window. Every morning these washwomen came up the hill from the trolley line on North Avenue and fanned into the houses. Traveling Italian gardeners kept the lawns trim. Icemen walked alongside their wagons, their horses straining in the traces to pull the creaking ice wagons up the hill. When the sun set that evening, it lay at the bottom of the hill as if it had rolled there. It was blood red. Late at night, the boy woke and found his mother sitting beside the bed, looking at him, her golden hair plaited and her large breasts soft against his arm when she leaned over to kiss him. Chapter 10. Actually, Father wrote every day during the long winter months, letters for delayed transmission which took the form of entries in his journal. In this way he measured the uninterrupted flow of twilight darkness. The members of the expedition lived in surprising comfort aboard the Roosevelt, which had been lifted in its berth by the winter floes until it sat like a walnut in icing. Perry lived the most comfortably of all. He had a player piano in his stateroom. He was a large man with a heavy torso and a thick red hair turning gray. He wore a long mustache. In a previous expedition he'd lost his toes. He walked with an odd gait, a kind of shuffle, pushing his feet along the floor without lifting them. He pedaled his player piano with toeless feet. He was supplied with rolls of the best Victor Herbert and Rudolf Frimmel numbers, as well as a medley of Bowdoin College songs and a version of the Minute Waltz of Chopin, which he could pump out in 48 seconds. But the winter months were not given to idleness. There were hunting sorties for muskox, there were sledges to be built, and the base camp had to be set up 90 miles away at Cape Columbia, the point from which the actual polar dash across the sea ice would be made. Everyone had to get used to handling dog teams and building igloo shelters. Perry's Negro assistant, Matthew Henson, supervised the training. After numbers of expeditions, Perry had developed a system. Every last detail of their lives in the Arctic represented his considered judgment and was part of the system. The material and designs of the sledges, the food that was to be eaten, the tins in which the food was to be carried, the manner in which the tins were to be lashed to the sledges, the kind of under and overclothing that was to be worn, the means of harnessing the dogs, the kinds of knives and guns to carry, the kinds of matches, and the means of keeping them dry, the design of the eye guards to be used against snow blindness, and so on. Perry loved to discuss his system. In its essentials, that is, in the use of dogs and sledges and the wearing of fur clothing and the living off local fauna, Perry's system merely adopted the Eskimo way of life. Father realized this with a start one day. As it happened, he'd been standing on the quarter-deck, observing Perry soundly scold one of the Eskimo men who'd not done his assigned chore properly. Then Perry shuffled back along the deck, passing Father and saying to him, "They're children, and they have to be treated like children." Father tended to agree with this view, for it suggested a consensus. He recalled an observation made in the Philippines 10 years before, where he'd fought under General Leonard F. Wood against the Moro guerrillas. Our little brown brothers have to be taught a lesson, a staff officer had said, sticking a campaign pin in the map. There was no question that the Eskimos were primitives. They were affectionate, gentle, emotional, trustworthy, and full of pranks. They loved to laugh and sing. In the deepest part of the winter, of continuous night, when terrible storms tore rocks from the cliffs and winds shrieked, and it was so desolately cold that Father hallucinated that his skin was burning, Perry and most of the men withdrew to the theoretical considerations of his system, and so protected themselves against their fear. The Eskimos, who had no system but merely lived here, suffered the terrors of their universe. Sometimes the Eskimo women would unaccountably tear off their clothes and run into the black storms, howling and rolling on the ice. Their husbands had forcibly to restrain them from killing themselves. Father kept himself under control by writing in his journal. This was a system, too, the system of language and conceptualization. It proposed that human beings, by the act of making witness, warranted times and places for their existence other than the time and place they were living through. But there seemed in this ice-bound winter night a force that gripped you by the neck and faced you into it. The Eskimo families lived all over the ship, camping on the decks and in the holds. They were not discreet in their intercourse. They cohabited without even undressing, through vents in their furrows, and they went at it with grunts and shouts of fierce joy. One day Father came upon a couple and was shocked to see the wife thrusting her hips upwards to the thrusts of her husband. An uncanny animal song came from her throat. This was something he could not write in his journal, except in a kind of code. The woman was actually pushing back. It stunned him that she could react this way. This filthy, toothless Eskimo woman with the flat brow and eyes pressed upwards by her cheekbones, singing her song and pushing back. He thought of a mother's fastidiousness, her grooming, and her intelligence, and found himself resenting this primitive woman's claim to the gender. The spring came, finally. And it was Perry's assistant, Matthew Henson, who called to Father one morning and pointed aft. A thin ray of light was in the southern sky. In the days that followed, distinctions in the kinds of darkness could be made, and these became more and more pronounced. Finally, one morning, there rose above the horizon a blurred and blood-red sun, not round but elliptically misshapen, like something born. Everyone became happy. Glorious colors, pink and green and yellow, lay upon the snow peaks. And the entire bleak, magnificent world offered itself to who would take it. The sky gradually turned blue, and Perry said the time had come to conquer the pole. The day before the expedition was to leave, Father went along with Matthew Henson and three of the Eskimos to the Bird Cliffs, a half-day's journey from the coast. They climbed the cliffs with sealskin bags hung over their shoulders and collected dozens of eggs, a great delicacy in the Arctic. When the birds flew up, chattering and circling, it was as if a portion of the rock cliff had come away. Father had never seen so many birds. They were fulmar and auk. The Eskimos held out nets between them, and the birds flew into the nets and became entangled. The nets were taken up at the corners and became sacks of immobile weighted feathers, chirping piteously. When the men had caught all they could carry, they made the descent and straightway slaughtered the birds. The fulmar, about the size of gulls, were wrung at the neck. But what amazed Father was the means by which the small and inoffensive auk was done in. One simply nudged the tiny heart in its breast. Father watched it done and then tried it himself. He held an auk in one hand and with his thumb gently squeezed the beating breast. Its head slumped and it was dead. The Eskimos loved the auklet and customarily pickled it in sealskins. On the way back to camp, Father and Matthew Henson discussed what the men under Perry always discussed, who would have the honor of actually going to the pole with him. Before the embarkation from New York, the commander had made it quite clear to everyone that he and he alone was to discover the pole. Their glory would be in support. "I've spent my life planning for that moment," Perry said, "and I'm going to have it for myself." This seemed to Father a reasonable point of view. He had the diffidence of the amateur before the professional. But it was Matthew Henson's view that someone besides Eskimos would have to go to the top with the commander, and he thought with all due respect it would be himself. Actually, Father believed Henson had a good case. Henson had been with Perry on his previous expeditions, and he was an astute and formidable Arctic explorer in his own right. He knew how to drive the dogs almost as well as an Eskimo. He knew how to repair sledges, build camps. He had great physical strength and boasted many skills. But Father found himself unaccountably resenting Henson's presumption, and he asked the Negro now how he knew he would be chosen. They had breasted a ridge along the trail and stood resting the dogs for a moment as they looked over a great white plain of snow. At that moment the sun broke through the overcast, and the entire earth flashed like a mirror. "Well, sir," Matthew Henson said with a smile, "I just know." The next day the expedition set out due north across the polar ice. They were arranged in separate parties consisting of a white man or two, a group of Eskimo boys, a pack of dogs, and 4 or 5 sledges. Each party, except Perry's, was to serve her week as pioneer or trailbreaker to the rest of the expedition. Eventually, each of them was to peel off and head back to land, leaving Perry and his boys to make the last 100 miles or so in fresh, relatively rested condition. That was the system. The big work was in breaking trail. This was hazardous and back-breaking labor. Ridges of ice had to be hacked away with a pickaxe. Heavy sledges had to be hauled and pushed up ice inclines, and then held against precipitous descents. Each sled carried over 600 pounds of tools and provisions. When it broke, it had to be unloaded and repaired by lashing the broken parts together, work that required an ungloved hand. There were leads of water that had to be crossed or waded out. The ice floes came together with great cracks like the sound of cannon, and rumbled underfoot like the voice of the ocean itself. Inexplicable fogs blocked out the sun. Sometimes there is nothing to do but crawl across thin sheets of forming ice. No one wanted to be caught on a drifting ice floe. The weather was a constant torment, the wind blowing so sharply at 50 or 60 degrees below zero that the air itself seemed to have changed its physical nature, being now unassimilable crystals in one's lungs. Each breath left its solid residue in the beard or on the frozen edges of the fur hoods. Everyone wore the prescribed soft sealskin shoes, the bare fur trousers, and the hooded caribou jackets, but even these indigenous materials turned brittle in the frost. The sun now stood above the horizon 24 hours a day. At the end of a day's travel, perhaps 15 miles of arduous effort, the pioneer group would make camp, build igloos for the pursuing expedition, feed the dogs, untangle their iced-up traces, light the alcohol cooker to brew tea, and fall to a meal of frozen pemmican and crackers. Slowly through the month of March, the Perry expedition made its way due north. One by one, a party would turn back, its obligations now to beat the return trail as thoroughly as possible to make it easier for the parties who would follow. Perry would bring up the lag each day on the outgoing run and immediately occupy one of the igloos built for him by Henson. In the meantime, Henson took care of Perry's dogs, repaired broken sledges, made supper, dealt with the Eskimos, many of whom were now becoming difficult. Perry defined the virtues of Eskimos as loyalty and obedience, roughly the same virtues one sought of the dogs. When the time came for the final run for the pole, now only 100 miles away, Perry did indeed choose Henson to go with him, and Henson chose the Eskimos who, in his judgment, were the best boys, the most loyal and devoted to the commander. The balance of the party was turned around and sent home. Father had long since gone back. He had pioneered the very first week. He had proven not the sturdiest member of the expedition. This was from no lack of heart, as Perry told him before sending him home, but from the tendency of his extremities to freeze easily. Father's left heel, for instance, froze every day, no matter what he did to protect it. Each evening in camp he would thaw it out painfully and treat it as best he could, and each morning it would freeze.